If data is the feedstock of intelligence, the U.S. intelligence community tends to keep its silos full of grain. Using that data, well, that's another matter. The Intelligence Advanced Research Project's activity is looking for high-payoff research in a variety of data-related fields, all aimed at producing what IARPA calls overwhelming intelligence superiority. Joining me with more, Dr. Jason Matheny, the IARPA director. Dr. Matheny, great to have you on.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be on.
So you are looking for outside researchers to fund for a variety of data-related issues. Are these grants or contracts, first of all?
Contracts. And we find that at some of our best ideas actually come from places we never would have expected. Those research contracts then are ways for us to get funding to scientists and engineers from around the world to work on some of our hardest problems.
All right. And one of the ones that I see that you are always looking at is anticipatory intelligence. Now, that sounds like crystal ball or what's future gazing. What does that word mean?
So that's our term for the kind of forecasting that the intelligence community does about geopolitical events. Those could be the outcomes of foreign elections or treaty negotiations. It could be political instability abroad, or my background, which was in disease modeling and disease forecasting. So how can we help public health by better detecting and anticipating disease outbreaks such as Zika, for instance, which is in the news, which we work quite a bit on. The reason for wanting to anticipate events is so that we can prepare for them. In some cases, we can send out travel alerts to, say, U.S. citizens if they're going to be traveling to a certain place. We can provide for greater security when we have personnel who are stationed overseas. And we can improve national security by anticipating those events that are likely to be most disruptive to the U.S. economy.
So you don't necessarily try to predict what will happen, but simply to know what might happen so that responses can be developed for what might happen.
Yeah, getting a better sense of what might happen is valuable, and getting a sense of what the probabilities are for those possibilities is also something that's quite helpful. One analogy that we sometimes draw is to weather forecasting. Your weather forecast doesn't know for certain what the weather will be, but will assign a probability to whether there will be rain, for instance. And those probabilities in general are pretty accurate. So out to about 2 weeks, weather forecasts are fairly accurate. And when the weather forecaster says the probability of rain is about 20%, she or he is right about 20% of the time.
And so how can that be automated? I mean, usually that's an analysis based on long experience. Like, for example, will Venezuela allow an election in the next year? You know, will Maduro allow that to happen? Huge consequences in either direction. What can you add to that that human intuition and experience can't add?
Well, we run research in forecasting that involves humans and machines. And what we find is that they both have different strengths. Really, the strongest forecasting system is one that complements what machines or statistical tools can do and what a human analyst can do. So to give you a few examples, one of the research projects that we worked on was the largest experiment in human judgment about geopolitical events. So we had tens of thousands of people participate from around the world who served as research volunteers to improve our understanding about human judgment, and they generated millions of forecasts for events around the world. Each of those forecasts was then scored for accuracy. So they would make forecasts about who would win a foreign election, or whether two countries would go to war, or whether there would be a civil war, whether there would be a weapons test. And then we would wait for the news to happen and then see who got it right, who got it wrong, and what distinguished the best from the rest in those cases of forecasting. And one of the things that we found that was surprising, at least for me, was that the best forecasters out of these tens of thousands of forecasters were not the deep domain experts, but were instead people who scored very highly on tests of critical thinking, who had high pattern recognition ability, and we're constantly looking for new information that might go against their gut instincts. So they were in a way looking for information to contradict themselves. Those critical thinkers outperformed everyone else in this tournament, And even maybe more surprising, the single best forecaster was not a single individual, but instead was just the unweighted average, the raw average of the 100 best forecasters.
Well, that could be a humbling experience for some of the deep subject matter experts. But after you have a contract for this, what is the result of the contract? What is the deliverable under a system like that?
So in some cases, the deliverable is a research result, a report that summarizes what's been learned in a research study. In other cases, it's a piece of software. And in some of our research programs where we build hardware, say new forms of computers, those pieces of hardware are the research deliverable.
And so if this type of deliverable results in the overwhelming intelligence advantage that IARPA is seeking for the IC, the intelligence community, how do you keep it in your own hands?
As a research organization, most of what we're funding is early stage. This is something that's not going straight to intelligence analysis or intelligence operation. In many cases where we do have something that is going to go into an operation or an analytic activity, in those cases, we do have to keep the research classified. The bulk of work, though, that we do is unclassified. It's published openly. And in fact, that's one of the great advantages of our research is that it can benefit from peer review and it can advance the whole of science.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Matheny, the director of the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. And I want to just pull on that thread a little bit. So if the research is in the public domain, enemies could also read it and use it. So how does that keep the advantage for the United States intelligence community?
In many cases, with geopolitical events, we don't have an enemy. I mean, the enemy may be instability or the enemy may be disease. And that's not a case where the enemy benefits from having published research. So let me give disease as an example. So we're lucky that Zika and chikungunya and Ebola don't know how to read so that we can generate methods that forecast those types of disease outbreaks without worrying that they'll become an intelligent adversary. In other cases, we do have to worry about what's published. And in those cases, we have to classify the research.
And what are some of the other research priorities for IARPA right now besides anticipatory intelligence?
Another one is using machine learning to improve our capabilities in human language analysis of video and analysis of imagery. I'll give a couple of examples. We have a new program called Material, which is focused on machine translation and information retrieval for languages that are under-resourced. That is, languages that have sufficiently few numbers of speakers that there isn't a large commercial market for generating a machine translation system. So Google and Apple and others provide machine translation for languages that have large numbers of speakers. The intelligence community and other parts of society, including the State Department, have an ongoing need for machine translation tools for those languages that don't have many speakers.
What are some of those, for example?
Beku, which is like a West African language, Creole, which is a language many of us have heard of, Zulu. There's other languages that are of sort of priority for either our diplomatic corps or for the intelligence analysis corps that aren't going to get sufficient attention from the commercial market. So for those languages, we need to develop research programs that focus on developing new tools.
So at some point in that whole complex, you would need a missing link, so to speak, someone that can speak Zulu and English. You just need at least one person, right?
So you need matched texts. So so this is sometimes called a bi-text, where you have the original and you have a translation, and you need a sufficient number of those examples in order to train a system. One of the goals of the Material program is to significantly reduce the number of examples that you need. In most historic cases of machine learning, you might need thousands of those examples. The goal here is to bring it down to dozens or hundreds of examples. Another example of a work that we do in machine learning is focused on video analysis. We have a program called DIVA, whose goal is to automatically detect in video whether there's an event occurring that's something that a security analyst should be paying attention to. For instance, somebody dropping a bag, somebody exchanging a bag with somebody else, somebody brandishing a weapon, somebody who's loitering at regular intervals. Those kinds of activities are ones that we want security monitors to be able to detect in real time. We don't want analysis simply to be focused on forensics after an event has happened, looking backwards and seeing what occurred. We want to be able to detect that and warn security personnel. It's really infeasible to do that just with human labor. So we have to find a way of automating that.
And that's the type of program that could really benefit a wide range of industry. Every hotel, every elevator operator, transit operators, I would think, could benefit from that because of how many cameras are out there that nobody can watch them all.
That's right. Police as well would benefit from having that kind of capability. A third example I can give of the way in which machine learning is applied to a range of analytic challenges is a program that we've had running for just a little while now called Core 3D. And the goal there is to develop rich 3D models of the globe from overhead imagery. Now, if you've ever used Google Earth, you can see what's an approximate 3D model, but it's sometimes referred to as melted chocolate, because if you look at your house from this 3D model, it looks as though it's melted in with the trees that are adjacent to it, maybe the car that's adjacent to it. It's all sort of one lump. What Core 3D is focused on is, how can we use our knowledge of the world? For instance, our knowledge that trees and houses are separate objects, to build more accurate representations of 3D objects on the ground.
This sounds like something that the NGA part of the intelligence community would be particularly interested in.
That's right. Yeah. So NGA is one of our partners in this research program. And in fact, the program manager comes originally from NGA.
Anticipatory intelligence and machine learning. You also mentioned high performance computing is an area, and a lot of federal agencies like the Weather Service and so forth are always attacking that one. What is IARPA looking at that might be unique for intelligence?
So IARPA has three different research thrusts in high performance computing that are very high risk, high reward research efforts. One is focused on quantum computing, which is a new form of computing that would allow us to solve problems that are otherwise impossible to solve using regular computers. So it exploits physical phenomena associated with quantum mechanics in order to solve very challenging computational problems. There's a second track of high-performance computing that we invest in called superconducting classical computing, or cryogenic computing, that reduces the energy cost of computing by about 100-fold. That's very attractive because for a lot of these large computers that are needed in government and in industry, they require many megawatts of energy. In order for us to keep up with the demand for computing, we need to find more efficient ways of computing, and superconducting computers allow us to do computation more efficiently.
So low resistance circuitry by having super cold circuitry?
That's right. That's exactly right. So the goal of our C3 program, as we call it, is to develop a new form of computing that uses superconductors for logic and for memory, reducing to zero the resistance in moving information around. A third category of computing that we invest in is called neuromorphic. And there the goal is to understand how the brain so efficiently computes. To give you an example, the human brain operates somewhere between 10 to the 15th and maybe 10 to the 18th operations per second. That's a lot. And if we were to use a electronic computer to calculate that quickly, we'd require many millions of watts of energy. The human brain, in contrast, uses only 20 watts of energy. So 1/1,000,000th the amount of energy. You can think with a cup of coffee and a banana, and yet it requires something like a small power station.
And it operates at room temperature.
And it operates at room temperature. That's right. And sometimes even warmer. So there's some computational tricks clearly that the brain is using that we could learn from. So
it's chemistry at some point, right?
It is, and it's also the wiring diagram that the brain has, which is remarkably complex and highly parallelized. So we have a program called Microns that's focused on understanding the wiring diagram of the mammalian brain in order to use it to develop the next generation computers and machine learning algorithms.
Maybe you can figure out why everything with a spinal cord yawns.
Is that true?
Yes. If all chordates yawn, even birds, if you ever watch them. We're speaking with Dr. Jason Matheny, the director of the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. And let's just zoom out for just a moment. In what you choose to do research on and award contracts in, there's a lot of other ARPAs throughout the government, including the granddaddy, DARPA. Do you all coordinate to make sure that everyone's not chasing the same researchers with the same dollars for the same purpose?
We do at multiple levels in the organization. So we figure out what we're going to fund that DARPA isn't already funding, or HSARPA or ARPA-E isn't already funding. We focus on the national intelligence research needs. In contrast, DARPA focuses on the DOD, the warfighter needs. HSARPA focuses on the homeland security needs, and ARPA-E focuses on the energy needs.
And where do your requirements tend to be generated from?
So we scan continuously for what are the research needs of the 17 intelligence agencies that serve the United States. And what that means is we look for some of the hardest problems that would have the biggest impact if solved, and we link those problems with a scientific community that involves scientists and engineers and academia and industry who are willing to take on that challenge. And most importantly, we measure progress against that challenge. So in contrast to, say, the National Science Foundation, which does an outstanding job of funding basic research, we fund applied research, and we keep score. We see which methods are actually working against real problems.
And are most of the recipients of these contracts educational institutions, some of the maybe the MITRs of the world, or all of the above?
More than half of our research funding goes to universities and colleges. And then of the other half, it's split almost evenly between small businesses and large businesses. We do federally funded research and development centers like the National Labs and other FFRDCs. You mentioned MITRE, IDA, RAND, and some others. But the bulk of the research that we're funding is really taking place at colleges and universities.
And do you consider yourself to have one of the most interesting jobs in all of the federal government?
Yes, I do. Very strongly, I feel quite privileged in this job. You know, sometimes the job is compared to being Q from the James Bond movies. But it's actually much better than that, because Q really relied on having his own laboratory in which to do all the work. So all the lab coats were in one place. And our problems are simply too numerous and too complex to solve in one laboratory. So we've crowdsourced Q. We've drawn in the best talent, Nobel laureates, Academy of Science members, IEEE fellows, in order to focus on our hardest problems.
So no expectation of a fusion-powered Aston Martin?
Not yet. But if we were going to go after one, we would put out a broad agency announcement in order to invite proposals from the public.
Dr. Jason Matheny is director of the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Tom.
You can read more and share this interview with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive and click Share with Friends.